You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
I feel that transrealism is the only valid approach to literature at this point in history. The transrealist writes about immediate perceptions in a fantastic way. Any literature which is not about actual reality is weak and enervated. But the genre of straight realism is all burnt out. Who needs more straight novels? The tools of fantasy and SF offer a means to thicken and intensify realistic fiction. By using fantastic devices, it is actually possible to manipulate subtext. The familiar tools of science fiction, time travel, anti-gravity, alternate worlds, telepathy, and so on, are in fact symbolic of archetypal modes of perception. Time travel is memory. Flight is enlightenment. Alternate worlds symbolize the great variety of individual worldviews, and telepathy stands for the ability to communicate fully.
Rudy Rucker is the author of science fiction novels that include Software, Wetware, Freeware, Realware, Freck and the Elixir, and Space-Time Donuts. His nonfiction includes Saucer Wisdom and The Life Box, The Seashell, and The Soul. He's considered one of the original cyberpunks, and Tales of Houdini was his story in the groundbreaking cyberpunk anthology Mirror Shades. He's the editor of Flurb, a webzine of astonishing tales. His new novel from Tor Books is The Mathematicians in Love, and his new short story collection from Thunder's Mouth Press is Mad Professor. Welcome to the program, Rudy.
It's nice to be here, Rick.
Rudy, let's talk about literary movements and literary trends in respect to your work as a cyberpunk. Tell us a little bit about the beginning of cyberpunk, because it really was a literary movement. It wasn't a literary trend, was it?
No, it was a movement. It was, initially I was alone. It was, I started writing science fiction about 1978, and I wasn't even really aware of the new wave in England. I just felt that science fiction used to be interesting when I was younger, and it didn't seem like it was interesting anymore. It was sort of something that happened a little bit like when rock and roll was eaten by disco. So I wanted to write science fiction that appealed to me, that was about real people doing sort of 60s kinds of things, you know, rock and roll, drugs, sex, which I wasn't really seeing very much in the commercial science fiction. And then I published two books, Software and Space-Time Donuts. And then I got a letter from Bruce Sterling, who was he was living in Austin, Texas then. And he had reviewed my books, and they were, in fact, the first good reviews I think they'd gotten. And they were in a free newspaper in Austin. And then he started sending me this zine he was doing called Cheap Truth, and about this idea of cyberpunk. William Gibson was starting to write stories then, and I loved them. They were right up my alley. John Shirley was becoming active then too, writing stories and novels. I had always wanted to be in a literary movement. Growing up, I really admired the beatniks, and I liked that idea of doing the same type of work with some other people and doing something somewhat revolutionary. And then I got to meet all the guys. I think we first met at Bruce Sterling's house. We all went down to Austin. They were having some kind of science fiction convention there with a special panel on cyberpunk. And though Gibson wasn't there, but I got to meet him too. And we all really hit it off and liked each other. And over the years, I've collaborated on stories with Sterling and Shirley a couple of times, and almost collaborated on something with Gibson, but he did give me some ideas. It was nice to have that feeling that you were part of a movement. Yeah.
What do you think happened to cyberpunk as the movement, you know, gained notice?
Well, in some sense, I mean, we four are still writing. You could still call it cyberpunk if you wanted to. It's still near future. And one of the key notions in cyberpunk, I think, was the idea of that humans are becoming more like machines and machines are becoming more like humans. And that was a somewhat less obvious idea in the 1980s than it is now. what then happened, it did pick up a sort of cultural cachet, and for instance, Blade Runner was sort of a, I would call that the, that and the Terminator, I would call those the two quintessential cyberpunk movies. And it sort of acquired this idea of being noir and rainy streets, colored electric lights reflecting on them, which, and Gibson does that a lot. My work is not necessarily always so noir. I'm maybe more of a California cyberpunk. I like to be out in the sun, on the beach, having surfing with robots and things. And then it caught on in other ways. There was this cool magazine called Mondo 2000 that was published in Berkeley. And they were some really funny characters who worked there. And they actually didn't know anything about computers at all. Their idea of using computers was to to take drugs and imagine they're having telepathic contact with people. That was their idea of the web. But low tech. But I got involved with them, and I helped them edit this book called The Mondo 2000 User's Guide to the New Edge. And that was that made the cover of Time magazine. That was sort of maybe, at least for me, the high point of cyberpunk, where I was involved in a book that was on the cover of Time, and it was the cyberpunk issue of Time magazine.
One of the things you talk about is that understanding humans as machines, that's something that's that understanding perception has become a lot more common recently with a lot of the understandings of science and neuroscience. We're understanding humans at a much deeper and more mechanical level now, aren't we?
Yes, I think that's the case. There's still a very large residue of mystery. My day job for the last 20 years was teaching computer science at San Jose State University here in Silicon Valley. And one of the courses I would teach was artificial intelligence. And it's sort of like the Wizard of Oz. You look behind the curtain and there's just some really, really cheap magic tricks. The science of artificial intelligence is really very primitive now, is the point I want to make. It's really, there's some things we can do. We can do a little voice recognition. We can do, robots that can move around reasonably well, but it's essentially just a whole bunch of patched together special routines and special tricks, and we don't have really any overview about how to really make an intelligent machine. So in some sense, there's still a lot of mystery.
One of the things that always stuck with me was something out of a Stanislaw Lem article where he purported to be describing the military systems of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he described was what he called synsects, synthetic insects. Mm-hmm. And what he said I thought that was really interesting was that after a while, we gave up our quest for artificial intelligence because it's not always that helpful to be intelligent. And mm-hmm. what we went after was artificial instinct. Mm-hmm. Because the instinct appeared, as he says, millions of years earlier mm-hmm. and is perfectly good enough to get a wasp from one side of the country to the other. That's what a truck driver does. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're done. Mm-hmm. And we're actually starting to see some of that now, too, aren't we?
Yes. One thing that I think would be really great would be to be able to create little machines that can fly as well as insects. You mentioned that example. Sometimes in a couple of my novels, I've had this idea of there being dragonflies. I have this image of something about the size of a dragonfly, and there's a little camera on its head. And we know we can make cameras very small now with CCD chips to pick them up like TV cameras. And then it would be nice if in basically every town in the country there was sort of this rack of these things, and you could go online and rent one of the dragonflies for an hour, and then you could fly around and look at stuff. And that would be, when you want to go somewhere, you can never really figure out what it's going to look like because you just see the sort of brochure type photos that are online, and it'd be nice to be able to do that. Then of course, well, it would bring up all sorts of privacy issues.
You better patent that idea. That sounds like somebody's going to do that real soon.
Well, I've published it in a science fiction novel. But patenting is, I think I'm happy just to be a science fiction writer.
Let's talk about your science fiction. In the introduction to your short story collection, Mad Professor, you go into lecture mode immediately and give your readers four different aspects of your short stories, of your fiction in general, that you feel are important. And the first thing you mention is thought experiments. So tell us, what is a thought experiment as a philosophical device and as a literary device, and where do they meet? Where do they differ?
Okay. I take that word actually, as you may know, from Albert Einstein, like to talk about Gedanken experiment. And he had this idea for a lot of his ideas about special and general relativity came from thought experiments. Like he would say, what if I could run as fast as a ray of light? Oh, and then what would the light beam look like if I was moving as fast as it was? And then that led him to realize that actually he couldn't run that fast. And so a thought experiment, it's you set up a science fictional world and you put something different in there. Like a thought experiment I'm currently involved in is, what if every object in the world became conscious? Somehow they're equipped with memory. And there's this idea that I picked up from Stephen Wolfram that being able to do complicated computation is actually a rather ubiquitous property of nature. A leaf blowing in the wind or water in a glass. It's computationally really as rich as a PC. Anyway, I get stuck then. I say, what if objects were conscious, and then what? And then I'm stuck. It's hard to think further than that because it's such an unusual, odd idea. And that's where I say, okay, I'm going to write a science fiction novel where this has happened. And so by going in and building up this whole environment where I have people in there reacting to these objects and then events are happening, and you're basically setting this huge sort of simulation in motion with these things in it, and then I'll discover things that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. So that's generally a lot of my science fiction. I'll say, or what if I could travel farther than infinity, or what if I could fly, or what if telepathy were real? And these things, you say, you can quickly get a short answer, but then you say, I want to simulate it and see what this whole world is like, and that's your thought experiment.
Thought experiments are interesting as literature. How useful are they at predicting the future? And how useful do you think is science fiction at predicting the future?
Well, I think science fiction, it's sort of a laboratory, as I say. It's in general, when we have, like in mathematics, we have some axioms, and then you say, well, what follows from these axioms? And you sort of have to do these very sustained effort to draw out these long, complicated consequences. And in physics, we have some laws of nature and then what follows from them. Again, it takes a lot of work. So in science fiction, when we're doing a thought experiment, we're imagining some sort of situation, and then we're performing this kind of sustained simulation. So whether or not we make accurate predictions of the future, now and then you get a lucky hit. Sometimes you'll see something coming that is obvious to you as a science fiction writer that might not be obvious to the average person. I would say in many ways when you're doing science fiction, it's not so much that your desire is really to predict the future. It's more to understand what's happening right now, because that in itself is something that tends to be veiled from us. It's only when you look back in time can you see what was going on.
One thing you mentioned in your introduction is that inspired narration is a more powerful tool than logical analysis. Mm-hmm. So with your thought experiments, science fiction novels as thought experiments, it sounds to me as if you're taking the scientific aspect of creating the laboratory of the thought experiment, the premise, mm-hmm. and then subjecting it to the literary methods of, say, the beat poets mm-hmm. who inspired you. Is that a good...
Well, analogy? Yeah, there's... I got my PhD in mathematical logic, so I'm very aware of the limitations of what logic can do. Sometimes you might imagine, well, you could just turn this crank and put something into a logical system and you'll get all the answers out. And the fact is that often you might be turning that crank for a trillion years before you get to an interesting answer. I mean, maybe logic will get there, but it takes a long time. And that's where, when we do let our creative side loose, our sort of more dreaming, imaginative side, there's a chance of shortcutting these very tedious logical processes and focusing also on humanity and emotions, which is something that is really the core of what makes a novel interesting.
One thing that interests me is a subject that's called futurology. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how would you describe futurology? Is it different than science fiction? I've never been really clear on that. So here's the expert.
Yeah, I've hung around a little bit with some futurologists. Actually, Bruce Sterling often gets futurology gigs. There's a group called the Global Business Network, and they will go to a business and help them do scenarios about what might happen to the things that they're interested in the next 10 years or even 20 years. And it's not terribly different from science fiction. I guess it tends to be more grasping, more humorless, less interesting, and more bogus. But other than that, futurology is a lot like science fiction.
I'd like to talk to you about one of your novels, maybe nonfiction, depends how you look at it, as futurology. That's Saucer Wisdom. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your concept behind that. Is it a novel? Is it nonfiction? How do you feel about it?
I think it would be best to market Saucer Wisdom as a novel. The Tor books, we made the decision to market as nonfiction, which I think the book might have done better if it had been marketed as a novel, because it's a very odd kind of novel. It's almost like a literary experiment, and the book arose in a very strange way. It was almost the year 2000, and there was this millennial kind of fever, and people really wanted to know what's happening in the future, but everybody was very anxious. I had a friend, Mark Frauenfelder, who now founded Boing Boing, but at that time he was working for Wired, and they had a Wired magazine, and they had a line of books. And he suggested I do a book making predictions about the future. And so I had maybe 50 little predictions that I had. And then he said, well, it would be kind of nice if there's a thread explaining how you found out these predictions. And then I said, okay, I've got it. I know a guy called Frank Shook, and he's been abducted by UFOs many times. And the UFOs have taken him into the future, and he's seen it, and I'm just reporting what he told me. And then I sort of got carried away with that, and I did this sort of Edgar Allan Poe thing of insisting that Frank Shook was real. And then as I was working on the book, Frank Shook took on more life and actually became like a novel, because then Frank Shook comes to my house. He doesn't think he's getting enough money, and he steals my typewriter, and then I have to go hunt him down in Santa Cruz.
And here we are.
Yeah. So it's... It is a series of prognostications, but it is threaded together by this story. One of the characters is Frank Shook, and the other character is Rudy Rucker.
And this would be certainly an example of this genre of fiction that you call transreal fiction.
Exactly.
We'll get back to transreal fiction, but I want to get to these other four aspects of all your fiction. Tell us a little bit about what you call power chords. I love this idea. It's a really great idea.
Well, that's... the things that you love about science fiction, there's certain things that you just see them and you're like, yeah, that's science fiction. The attack of the giant ants, the arrival of the time machine, the UFO with the aliens coming out, the 100-foot-tall woman, the intelligent slime mold, the ray gun. These things, you're just, yeah, that's science fiction. And I like writing about those things, and they haven't really been exhausted, I don't think. And I call them power chords because in the way there's certain kinds of things that you'll hear, like AC/DC or the Ramones or Keith Richards or Rancid do on the guitar, and you just hear this, you say, yeah, that's, you know, this is rock and roll. This is the real thing. And there's so I like to use that stuff in my science fiction, and I don't feel shy. Some people get a little effete, and they say, oh, well, this is corny. This is B-movie. I can't have a flying saucer, you know, but why not? And at a deeper level, I would also say you can basically pick any power chord, and it turns out usually it's the reason it appeals to us, it's some sort of archetype that relates to something in our consciousness.
As you mentioned, time travel being analogous to memory.
Exactly. Time travel is like memory, and telepathy is the fantasy that at some time somebody might actually understand what you're talking about.
I'd like to talk to you about a concept that I think is really key to understanding a lot of your fiction, especially your new novel, Mathematicians in Love. This is the concept of the gnarl. Tell us, what is the gnarl and what is gnarly?
Well, that's a word I became fond of when I moved to California in 1986. And it just cracked me up. I think I actually heard some surfers saying that word. You know, the waves are gnarly, or that food is gnarly, or she's a gnarly person, using it in all sorts of ways. And then the dictionary meaning of gnarl would be when you have this sort of excrescence on a tree, this lump where it's sort of very twisty sorts of wood. And so I like the idea of things that are – I got into computer graphics when I came to California, and I like the Mandelbrot set and cellular automata and things where you would get these very extremely complex and twisty patterns in computer graphics, and I came to think of those as gnarly patterns. And then as I studied the theory of computation some more, and again, I was greatly influenced by the work of Stephen Wolfram, and he distinguished between different kinds of computation, or natural process. Something might either just sort of die out and not get anywhere, or it might be periodic, or it might be completely like radiostatic or TV snow, which is completely random. And then, but there's this sort of interface zone between something that's periodic and something that's just blown out and random, and that's the gnarly zone. It's where you have patterns, but they're patterns that don't repeat. They're intricate. They're complicated. And you can make a pretty good case that that's the zone of life. All living things are behaving in a gnarly fashion. They have some periodicity, but it's kind of not a predictable periodicity. You don't sleep the exact same number of minutes every night. You know, your breaths are slightly different. Nothing is quite perfectly periodic, but it's not. On the other hand, it's not like you're just this pile of goo. So I like this idea of gnarly. And then I also like the cultural association, gnarly dude, you know, that cracks me up. So even my sort of personal slogan, if you had to put one thing on my gravestone, it would probably be seek the gnarl.
One of the things about the gnarl is you bring this up in Lifebox. And so tell us, what is a Lifebox? I think this is an interesting concept, but I'm...
Well, that's a science fictional concept I've written about in some of my short stories, and I think in some of my novels as well. And it's an idea that is just about here. You can already, in fact, you can get like a cell phone and you can take lots of pictures with it. You can record things you care about. You could put links there. You could put text in there. And you could get a lot of information about yourself into this sort of handheld device. And people... it's often the case that when someone retires or when they turn 70, they want to write a memoir. And then that's when people discover that writing is difficult. But an easy way they could do this would be if they had something sort of like an MP3 player or a cell phone, and it would ask you questions. You'd talk to it. It would record what you said. And then it would have built into it an interface, a voice recognizing interface, so if you talked to it, you said, well, tell me about your first car. Then it would dig through its database, and it would play back a story of the Lifebox owner talking about his first car. And you could interrupt him and ask more questions. And it would become, in the end, like having a conversation with someone. And I think this technology is really almost here. It'll be very common in about 10 years. Whether the Lifebox can wake up and do original thought, of course, that's the hard part. We can make something that emulates somebody. You basically just have this enormous database of everything they've said or everything they've written. In a way, you could say that my website is my Lifebox, because pretty much there's a huge amount of data that I've put up there, photographs and things that I've written. And like my blog is searchable because there's a little box where you can type in some word, and then it'll give you all my blog entries mentioning that word. And sort of, in a way, it's almost at the point where using it would be a little bit like having a conversation with me. Now, my book, The Lifebox, The Seashell, and the Soul, that title, it's what you'd call a dialectic triad, because the Lifebox idea is maybe I can get my personality and crush it into this digital database. And the soul is the idea, that's our feeling that there's something we have that's more than a machine. There's something in me. There's this inner light. There's this glowing consciousness inside me. So I'm not really a life box. And then the synthesis between these two is this idea of a seashell. And there's a particular kind of seashell that Stephen Wolfram talks about. It's the South Pacific textile cone shell, and it has these patterns on it that are very good examples of gnarly patterns occurring in nature. They're very intricate, but they're not repetitive. The point that I'm getting at in this book is, suppose that you took a life box and animated it by giving it a program that was gnarly in its operation, that would not be periodic, but on the other hand, wouldn't be confusingly random. It's possible that that could produce behavior that seemed like a living being. So in that sense, the seashell is the synthesis between the life box and the soul.
This is reminiscent of something you say about writers and novels, in that you quote Burroughs about this, that a novelist has to create a world, and then when they create that world, they have to walk around and explore it, and they might find that it has stuff that they didn't intend to be there. So talk a little bit about this and how that informs your own writing.
Writing is my favorite thing to do, because I think maybe I find it frustrating in the real world how little control I have over things, particularly on the political front. Though, of course, if I'm doing something like walking on the beach, that's maybe more fun than writing, because it's beautiful. You're soaking up nature. So I'm not like totally wanting to be in my room all the time. But I do like to get into the world of my novels, because it's fun. It's like dreaming while I'm awake, because I see what I'm writing about. I have visual images of everything, and I'm essentially imagining it and then describing it. Sometimes in the evening, I find it, rather than reading a book, I would rather just lie there with my laptop and work on the next scene in my book, because then it's almost relaxing for me. I'm watching something that I like to see and seeing how it unfolds. And it is nice if it surprises me a little bit, because again, I want the novel to be gnarly in the computational sense, that I don't want it to be predictable. Certainly it's a good idea to have a novel outline, to have an outline of your novel so you know what you're doing. But it's also the case that it's okay if then things happen that weren't in the outline, because you sort of want that to happen. Because if nothing unexpected happened, then the book would probably be kind of dull. And there are books like that, and those aren't books that I like to read. I like books where unexpected things can happen. If I get a good enough model of the characters, they'll sometimes say things that actually strike me as funny, and that it seem almost unexpected to me. It might even make me laugh. A type of input I like to incorporate sort of, when a novel's going well, I begin to feel sometimes that the world is helping me, because I will go outside and I will see just the kind of person I need to see, or just the physical object that I need to see. Like I'll need some sort of magical science fiction device, and I'll go outside and I'll just find something on the sidewalk that just looks like just that right kind of thing, like a crystal or a twisted piece of wood, and then I'll bring it home and put it on my desk, and it goes into the novel. So that's, I like that.
You were talking about your characters making you laugh, and one of the things that's interesting about your work is you've got a great sense of humor, but you don't exactly tell jokes.
Well, yeah, that's it. I do. I'm almost congenitally unable to write something that people don't think is funny. And even though sometimes I'll even not want to be funny. And then I find this when I speak to groups of people too. I think I'm being serious, and then everybody starts laughing. And I think it's just because I have such an unusual way of looking at things. And then people are surprised. And when you're surprised about something, then it makes you laugh. But I do like to have my novels be amusing and funny. That's something. When you point out something weird about society, there's this sort of release of tension. It's like you've named the elephant in the living room. There's this sort of, oh, now we can laugh because we're not frightened. So that's one type of humor. And the other is to have characters that are just so out of it and bizarre that you kind of have to laugh at the way they act. And having been a mathematician and a science fiction writer and a computer programmer, I've hung around with plenty of very bizarre people. If you just describe them exactly as they are, it seems incredibly funny sometimes.
Let's talk about transrealism and your latest novel, which is, I think, a perfect example of transrealism. It's called Mathematicians in Love, and it's set in Berkeley. No, it's set in Humelock, which what a great...
Yeah, the British empiricists.
British empiricists. Transreal fiction is this idea of writing something that's both grittily realistic but infused with bits of stuff that's completely fantastic. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about when did you come up with this idea of the transreal?
It was pretty early in my career. Well, really, my first novel, Space Time Donuts, was transreal. It was sort of like my experience of going to graduate school. And then my novel, White Light, that was even more transreal. It was about being a teacher at a small college in upstate New York. In that novel, I leave my body and I go beyond infinity to this place where infinity is real. And that was a sort of an objective correlative for two things. One was I'd had one or two psychedelic experiences where I felt like I had, you know, seen something beyond ordinary reality. And also as a practicing mathematician, I was regularly kind of leaving the world and going into this realm of infinite sets. A way to make that interesting to write about is to have it actually physically happen to a person. And so in Mathematicians in Love, I'm kind of drawing back on some of my experiences as a graduate student in mathematics, but I have this guy, he's a student at Berkeley, or Humelock, as I call it, because it sort of starts out in a different parallel world from ours and ends up, at the very end, they end up in our world. I like observing. I feel fortunate to live in an interesting part of the world. I mean, it's Silicon Valley is interesting. California is interesting. San Francisco and Berkeley are interesting. Santa Cruz. And I like seeing these colorful, interesting people and then trying to capture some of what they're like into my fiction.
One thing you said that what started you off was somebody describing A Scanner Darkly, which is a science fiction novel by Philip K. Dick, as a transcendental biography.
That's right. A transcendental autobiography.
Autobiography.
And in a way, that's what it was, because that book, it's about a period when he was living in some whipped little house. I think it was in San Rafael. I can't remember. And he was taking a lot of speed, and these fairly rough street type people were living in his house with him. And Scanner Darkly, it's these people, they're addicted to something called Substance D. And that book, to me, that's an example of a book that I found very funny. It made me laugh a lot when I first read it, because the characters they're like completely stoned out and hopeless. And in a way, it's depressing, but their view of reality is so skewed and odd. And Phil Dick had a very deft touch with reporting, just describing in a flat way the way people talk. And the way California people talk is, he was very good at capturing that cadence. And it was really a nice book. And yeah, when I first read that book, on the back there was a blurb from somebody, I can't remember who, maybe Norman Spinrad. And he said it was a type of transcendental autobiography. And that struck me, well, loving the Beats as I did, I always sort of really wanted to write novels about myself, like Jack Kerouac or William Burroughs, maybe less so Burroughs. But Burroughs' book, Junkie, was about himself, and of course, On the Road. But then I thought, well, I can't just do that again. And also, my life actually isn't that exciting compared to these guys. I'm a professor, I'm married, I have children. But then I thought, what if I add science fiction to this? So what if I write about my life and real people and with the real politics, but then use science fiction for the excitement? And that's sort of where I got the idea.
Your new novel, Mathematicians in Love, it has cephalopods in it. You've got jellyfish in it. These are very Lovecraftian touches, and I'm wondering if the work of H.P. Lovecraft has had much influence on your work, because in many ways he had that kind of transreal glow to his work. You'd look at reality and realize there was something, in his case, very hideous hidden behind it.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I never thought of it that way. But yeah, he does write about ordinary life, and then there's something really bizarre lurking under it. And in a way, Edgar Allan Poe sometimes does that too. But Lovecraft, I guess maybe my favorite work of his is At the Mountains of Madness, and they're in Antarctica, and they find this cave, and there's these ruins left by these creatures that looked like giant sea cucumbers. He calls them radiolarians, but echinoderms, starfish, sea cucumbers. So I've always liked having those kinds of creatures. And there's something about when you go to the invertebrate kingdom, you don't have this brotherly sense that you feel towards a dog, you know, when you talk about a sea cucumber or a jellyfish. And so they're well suited for being aliens, I think.
I'd like to ask you, what other authors do you think now who are working in the realm of transrealism, either consciously or unconsciously?
Well, certainly Philip K. Dick was doing it, but he's not around anymore. In science fiction writing, maybe Cory Doctorow, to some extent, is doing that. He likes to write about sort of near future things about people like himself, and then something unusual happens to them. My friend John Shirley is, in a way, a transrealist. He writes about horrific things happening to people very much like himself. He's a maybe less optimistic transrealist than I am.
Let's talk now about Mathematicians in Love. This is based on your experiences as a grad student, as you say, but it's also based on something I think that a notion out of your tract on transrealism is that consensus reality is a form of mind control. And I really like this idea.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about Mathematicians in Love, it doesn't look like it, and it's probably the most political novel that I've ever seen that involved giant flying squid creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about the political aspects behind this and how this consensus reality versus the transreal reality.
Well, there was a couple of elements in Mathematicians in Love. One thing that I sort of got on the wave just as it was growing was this idea of video blogging, which when I wrote the novel, I guess a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, that was really just sort of a gleam in the eyes of the nerds out there. And now we've got YouTube, which everybody's watching, and everybody's posting videos of themselves. So, but I had this idea that that would be something that sort of would liberate us from the media if everybody was making their own TV channels. The real political element in the book, it has to do with our ongoing, I think politically we're in very dark times in the United States. I used to say things were worse under Reagan or Nixon, but I think these 6 years under George Bush have been a real low point in our nation's history. And it's come to the point where as an artist, I feel it's up to me to speak up and do what I can, if not to bring down the government, which would be too much to hope, but at least to provide succor and comfort to my fellow intellectuals that feel oppressed by the goons that we have running the country. So I sort of had this idea. I have this evil president in the book called Joe Doakes, and he has this campaign he's running. His party's the Heritagist Party, and he has this 100% Heritagist campaign, which is really quite close to what we were hearing from the Republicans.
Sure, that was the Tom DeLay idea, was permanent majority for the Republicans.
Right, and it wasn't enough that they take over 80% of the Congress. They had to have 100%, and then they were going to vote out all of the judges, because impeach all the Democrat judges, and 100%, 100% Heritagism. And so I had fun having this Joe Doakes making a speech about that. And then my characters, through means I won't go into in detail, well, basically they give a really successful, large, heavy metal punk rock concert in the baseball stadium in San Francisco. And they're distributing these devices that let people see what's actually going to happen in the future if 100% heritageism succeeds. And what people are seeing is, you know, dreadful, sort of like what we're seeing on the news every night. And so suddenly he manages to bring down the government. And so that was very gratifying for me.
One of the things that this novel does, I'd like you to tell us what the standard, give us your summary of the standard science fiction idea of notion of what's called this technological singularity,
mm-hmm.
which is?
Suppose we could build computers that were as intelligent as ourselves. And if you could get computers up to that level, then you could go ahead and put in double their memory, get chips that are twice as fast, and you'd have something that perhaps would be maybe not twice as intelligent as a person, but maybe a little bit better. And then this new machine could itself set to work designing a better machine, and you might have this sort of chain reaction, this sort of explosive growth in machine intelligence, so that it could happen in a very short period of time, that artificial intelligence could reach unprecedented levels.
And this is something we've actually, last summer I attended something called the Singularity Symposium.
Yes.
Over at Stanford.
I think I went to that too.
It was pretty interesting. But one of the things I think you do really well in this book is come up with a very different spin on the singularity. And so tell us a little bit about what you call paracomputing. I think that you referred to this earlier, and I really like this idea.
Well, yeah, I think when people talk about the singularity these days, I think they're a little too fixated on digital computers. It's almost as if you had some people in the 19th century saying, pretty soon there's going to be this really, really good watch, and that's going to change everything. I think it's a safe bet that in 100, 200 years, we're not going to be using digital computers. We're going to be doing something else. This, again, comes from my interest in Stephen Wolfram's new kind of science, this idea that natural processes can be thought of as computations. In that sense, you could say, well, maybe instead of making better digital computers, we could harness the computational power that's in nature. We could get something like a vibrating membrane and maybe get that to be doing, you know, this incredibly profound computations for us. Sometimes people call this non-traditional forms of computation. I think there's a journal of non-traditional computation now. I think they asked me to do something for them, but as I say, these days I just want to write science fiction. But the thing is, nature, everything's happening in parallel. It's very rich. So there could be this idea. And what happens in Mathematicians in Love, they find a way to basically take this sort of vibrating membrane and use it to simulate the world in such a way that they become able to predict the future. And that's, then we look at some of the things that play out there. Of course, the heritageists want to get control of it and use it to control the mass media, to control public opinion. They have been very good at doing this. And then my characters want to try to use it for more a liberating force. And they actually managed to do that.
And one of the things that I think is real interesting is that as opposed to the singularity seen as computational, where the intelligence that it creates are so godlike that we can no longer comprehend them, you've got in here in Mathematicians in Love, you have a vision of the singularity as if everybody could understand and look at the future, that so many possible predictions of the future, all of a sudden the future itself sort of dissolves in a kind of feedback loop. So it's, in a sense, time travel almost as a form of the singularity.
Well, there's a lot of interesting paradoxes that come up if we become able to predict the future, because then pretty much the stock market is going to have to close down, because the lottery is not going to work, because everybody's going to buy the winning number. And so a lot of things like that are going to change.
You also have a very interesting notion of docile worlds and non-docile worlds. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by that. I like that idea.
Yeah, that's a kind of notion that people wouldn't have even thought of about 10 or 15 years ago. And the idea has to do with, if we think of the world as being like a computation, then what we believe to be true about our world is that the computation is so gnarly, so complicated, that there's no shortcut for predicting it. So in other words, in my novel, they are able to predict the future, but that's only because they're not in our world. They're in a parallel world, what I call a docile world. And I would maintain that in our world, no matter how good a computer you had, and no matter how much you knew about the present, you still wouldn't be able to make a prediction that went out more than about 10 minutes, a really accurate prediction. And the reason is simply because there's no shortcuts. There's a, sometimes we speak of incompressible computations or irreducible computations. What's happening in reality, what's going on in your head, for instance, you say, well, why can't I predict what mood I'll be in when I wake up tomorrow morning? And the thing is, the only way you can get from here to tomorrow is to live through the intervening hours. And the whole time, your brain is sort of computing away at its maximum possible rate. And it's not like you can take those 12 hours of computation and find some shortcut for predicting what the result's going to be. And that's, in a way, that's not that surprising a notion, but it's something that we never thought that way about 10 years ago. It just wasn't kind of a mode of thinking that would occur to us. Because if you think of it, there's only so many shortcuts that there could be. There's like a shortcut has some simple rule. There's only so many simple rules. And it stands to reason that most of the time, what you're doing is not going to be obeying any one given simple rule. And so in that sense, our world is not docile. It's fierce. It's gnarly. It's not predictable. And that's what makes life interesting. And that's the kind of novel that I like to write as well.
One thing that I really liked about Mathematicians in Love is the way it transformed the way I saw the world when I was reading it. And this is because of this notion that you just were talking about, that math underlies everything. At the core of everything, there's some, like, somebody is writing an equation that describes the entire world. And so one of the experiences I think that people who read this novel have is I was sitting reading it, and I looked out. I was in a restaurant. And I looked out, and I saw a row of trees, and it was windy, and the leaves were just changing. They were different colors, and they were just flashing at me in a pattern, but it was a very complex pattern. And my thought was, boy, somebody could write an equation to describe what those leaves are doing. Or more importantly, those leaves could be used to compute something, which is what you're kind of getting at in this book, isn't it?
Yeah, I very much enjoy looking at the wind moving trees around. That's what and I love looking at the ocean and clouds. Clouds, I always think, if there's only one place in the world where you could see clouds, like everybody would be flocking there. I think we don't pay enough. Clouds are so fascinating. We just take them for granted. We don't even look at them. But I'm always happy if that's one thing in an environment like a mall. It's hard to find any example of what I call natural gnarl, where you see some sort of like a leaf waving in the wind or a fire flame or some flowing water. We often box ourselves up into these rooms where if you really need to say gnarly, you can always get out your handkerchief and sort of wave it around and look at the undulations of the fabric. But yeah, all these, when you see something like the leaves on the tree, that's a good example where, in a way, there's some, maybe a simple equation underlying it. There's the laws of fluid flow, and we've got a certain amount of air and a certain number of leaf positions. But the leaves they're compound, complex pendulums, and they begin rocking in these unpredictable ways. And again, the distinction that's new and that we didn't used to make is that something can be deterministic but not predictable. We tend to think that they're synonyms, but they're not. Something can be obeying some law of nature, but it's not predictable because what it's doing is so complicated that the time it would take you to actually calculate what it's going to do would take longer than the thing actually doing it. So you could compute it, but no faster. You can't compute the world any faster than it's happening.
One of the least computable aspects of the world you cover in a short story in Mad Professor called Jenna and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really great story. So why don't you tell us the story behind this story?
Yeah, this is a story I wrote with my son. His name is also Rudy Rucker. He runs an ISP in San Francisco called monkeybrains.net. For some reason that I could never quite understand, he thought it would be funny or artistic or interesting to make a website about Jenna Bush and her sister. So he had this site called firsttwins.com, and it even got mentioned on page 6 of the Post, and he got huge numbers of hits. Since he was running an ISP, he could afford the... When you have a really popular site, you have to actually pay for the amount of internet usage, but that he was able to fold that into his business. But then people could post on there, and inevitably somebody posted some sort of threat. So then the Secret Service came to see Rudy and questioned him about what he's up to. And I think they figured out that he's just a young guy in San Francisco, and there's nothing much to worry about. But then another thing happened was that then there was a virus, a key sniffing virus that started recording everybody's keystrokes. And the guy who had written that virus had an account on Rudy's website, and he had some crazy website name for himself. It's like ijustgotfired.com or something like that. And he, amassed about a trillion bytes of secret data that came in there. And so then the FBI came and they wanted Rudy to open up his computers and give him all this data. And in the end, I think he had to do that. I said to Rudy, well, why are you doing this? What is this site about Jenna? Maybe I can help you figure out what it is that you're really doing. Let's write a trans-real science fiction story about this. So then we wrote this story, Jenna and Me. And then what happens in the story is, well, it's the usual kind of thing. I mean, Jenna's brain gets eaten by aliens, and they're trying to drug Chelsea Clinton, and Jenna takes the pill instead. And then they bring her brain back with all the recorded cell phone conversations that they have that ended up on his website. And then the aliens come and the UFOs. So it was a nice power chord science fiction story.
We've been speaking with Rudy Rucker. His new novel is Mathematicians in Love. His new short story collection is Mad Professor. He is not mad. He's not even angry. He's just really smart. Thank you for joining us, Rudy.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.